I call this meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy to order. Let the record reflect that it is 10:20 a.m. on Tuesday, February 8th, 2022. I want to thank our House Records Secretary, Sophia Tenney, and our LIO moderator, Talia Ames, for helping us with behind-the-scenes work for our committee today. As we start, I want to remind committee members to please have your phones on silent. And present with us today, we have Representatives Tuck, Klayman, Zolkowski, Kaufman, and myself, Chair Schrage. And today in the committee, we'll be taking up House Bill 299, Microreactors in Small Communities by the Governor. This is the first hearing on HB 299. Is there anything to come from the committee members before we get started? Not seeing anything. I'd like to welcome to our committee Gwen Holdman, Director of the Alaska Center, Center for Energy and Power at UAF. Welcome, Ms. Holdman. I know that we also have a few experts online, and I'll let you introduce them as you see fit. As a reminder for our presenter and our experts, if you could please identify yourselves when changing speakers to answer questions, that would be helpful for our House Records Secretary. With that, Ms. Holdman, please put yourself on the record and begin with your presentation. Good to have you here with us today.
Thank you, Chair Schrage. My name is Gwen Holdman. I'm the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I live in Fairbanks. Thanks for inviting me here to introduce this bill and thank the administration proactively for working on this issue by sponsoring House Bill 299. This is a technology and a topic that we've been working on for over a decade at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. And I'm really looking forward to sharing more current information about micronuclear reactors and potential applications for Alaska. The changes to state statutes proposed by this bill closely follow recommendations we made in a 2021 report prepared for the legislature and which I've previously shared with committee members. If we could switch to the first slide, Ryan, I'd like to acknowledge, as you mentioned, Chair Schrage, that we have several of our national lab collaborators that who have made themselves available to help answer any questions that the committee might have this morning. Specifically, Ashley Finnan is the director of the National Reactor Innovation Center at Idaho National Lab, and they're working really closely with developers and vendors to facilitate development and demonstration of advanced reactor systems, and she can help us answer technical questions about reactor designs that could be suitable to Alaska applications. Mark Nutt from the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory is the Deputy National Technical Director of the Department of Energy Nuclear Energy's Integrated Waste Management Program. And Mark can help answer technical questions about management of spent nuclear fuel generated by advanced reactor designs. And Bruce McDowell is a senior advisor also at the Pacific Northwest National Lab and has been involved with environmental impact statements for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's early site permits. And he's here today to help answer questions regarding potential environmental impacts of reactors siting. I really appreciate their time here today. This is an area that we've been working and drawing very closely, very much from the expertise that we have at the national level related to these technologies. And so these longstanding partnerships that we have with the national labs in this area have been really fantastic.
And I'd like to interrupt to let the record reflect that Representative Fields joined us at 10:21. Please continue.
Great. Thanks. So I'm not able to see my slides, so I probably should have numbered them, but I think we're on the slide on the Alaska Center for Energy and Power right now, and I just wanted to really quickly highlight the purpose of our program. We were formed about 12 years ago, based at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, very much as an applied energy research center, focusing on the kinds of issues and challenges that are facing Alaska residents, communities, and industries in the energy space. And so we've got a fairly large research group now, about 50 or 60 researchers that are both in Fairbanks, Anchorage. We have a couple of folks in Juneau as well. And as I mentioned, we work really closely across the state and with partners both at the national level and internationally as well on areas that are of specific interest to Alaska. And this has been one area, as I mentioned, that we've been following for quite a while. Next slide, please. These are some other areas that we have been working in. And so you can kind of see that we both have a statewide focus and we're really looking pretty broadly across the spectrum at both renewable technologies and non-renewable technologies. And this is an area that we think has some potential applications for our future energy mix in Alaska, both for more urban areas like the rail belt and potentially more remote applications as well. Just moving on to the next slide. So ASAP, just want to reiterate that we do work really closely with the private sector in a lot of these spaces. We have about 40 active projects right now. The majority of those are in partnership with or funded through private sector. Most of our funding does come from national sources, primarily Department of Defense and Department of Energy are our primary funding sources. And when we collaborate closely with, as I mentioned, national labs and all kinds of other partners in and outside the state. Next slide, please. So we first became involved with microreactors or small modular reactor technologies about a decade ago when the legislature asked that we take a look at this technology and potential applications for Alaska. So we prepared a report in 2011 that really reviewed the history of nuclear energy in Alaska. There's been a number of actual and proposed projects, some of the legacy of some of the testing and demonstration that was both proposed and done in Alaska in the past. And so that report summarizes a lot of those findings. And then at that time, really looking at the technology status and then considering what the economics and siting feasibility might be for reactors. At that time, a decade ago, there really weren't any reactor designs that were under development that really clearly fit the kind of size range that would make sense for an Alaska application. But that's really changed quite a bit in the last decade. And so that's what I'm hoping to kind of update this committee on. Next slide, please. So this updated report to the legislature really does show the real renaissance in this particular space at the national level. There's been a tremendous amount of activity. There's been a lot of interest. And there's a lot of vendors working in this space, developing technologies that would better meet the opportunity space that we have here in Alaska for this technology. So in addition to kind of continuing to track those trends, we also proposed or recommended creating a state working group on small nuclear energy as a forum to bring together stakeholders, both from Alaska and at the national level that are interested in potential Alaska applications. And so we've moved forward and convened that group for about the last 6 months or so now on a monthly basis. And creating a roadmap for Alaska nuclear applications is another recommendation that we made that is something that we're hoping to move forward with. We just hosted a workshop last week that brought together stakeholders to sort of lay out or frame some of the questions that Alaskans have related to this technology that could help inform that kind of a roadmap. And then finally, reviewing and revising Alaska state statutes related to nuclear energy, and that's really what the purpose of this bill is about. So next slide, please. Just to give a little bit of background about nuclear energy, I think when people hear the word nuclear energy, everybody has some preformed notion of what we're talking about there, and it is a really important part of our national energy mix. It supplies about 20% of U.S. electric power needs. That actually exceeds all renewables together, including hydro. We hear a lot about renewables, but nuclear is really a big part of the backbone of our national energy supply. And we actually produce more energy, nuclear energy, than any other country in the world. The big concern people have is often related to the safety, and that's pretty understandable. But the reality is that the nuclear energy industry has a really incredible safety record. And with the 60-year history of nuclear power industry in 36 countries, there's only been 3 significant accidents. And, you know, we know about those. The most recent one is Fukushima and then Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. And only one of those, which is Chernobyl, actually resulted in any deaths. And so that's just something that I think people should be aware of. Next slide, please. So microreactors are pretty different from what we have come to generally think about as a nuclear power reactor in the rest of the country. I know I grew up myself in northern Illinois near the Byron reactor, and I remember working on getting a private pilot's license and flying around that reactor and just being really amazed by the size of that and the size of the zone around it, you know, that was pretty impressive. And this is a really different technology than what we're talking about with those legacy kinds of reactors. So these are very small reactor designs with a pretty small amount of nuclear material associated with each individual reactor. And so the size of these, and these are some of the attributes that we commonly consider to be associated with microreactor designs, we're talking about an output of, you know, one to maybe a couple dozen megawatts of electric power output. So just to kind of give some context, I'm sitting here at UAF. There's a heat and power plant here. That's a 20 that has the potential of putting out 20 megawatts of electric power. So just to kind of provide some context, we're talking about something that's probably quite a bit smaller than a UAF power plant in general. And so another feature that I think is really interesting for Alaska applications is that they're capable of load following and providing heat in addition to electric power. That's true of all reactor designs, but generally speaking, in the rest of the country, they're considered base load assets. So you're basically running at the same output all the time. And this idea that they could potentially load follow and potentially help us firm up our grid with renewables coming online and things like that is, I think, a really interesting feature. They're factory fabricated and transportable, almost fully assembled. And so the idea is that that reactor vessel is built to very specific tolerances in a factory and then can essentially be transported to site in a completely sort of contained and packaged system versus the amount of construction that's typically done associated with a conventional nuclear power plant. And that's really a direction that the nuclear industry in general is going toward. Microreactors are slightly different from what we call small modular reactors, which are also small reactors, maybe a little bit bigger than a microreactor, that maybe are designed to be installed in series of like 6 or 12 units. And sort of that idea, again, of having a more modular approach to nuclear energy with less nuclear material, allowing more inherent or passive safety features associated with those that might replace the conventional nuclear power generation industry in the future. So I mentioned, like, again, these passive safety operating features and fuel designs that we associate with advanced reactor designs is probably, to me, the most interesting and most important attribute of this microreactor technology space. And then this idea of, like, semi-autonomous control and on-site staffing related to the reactor itself. The power generation equipment, for the most part, is really conventional power generation equipment. This is essentially a heat source that you can use to, for example, generate steam and use that to drive a turbine using conventional equipment. And so obviously there's still manpower associated with any kind of conventional power generation. But the reactor itself operates fairly with autonomous control systems, or that's the intention. And then really long intervals without refueling, so up to 10 years. And the idea is that for many of these designs, the entire reactor, when it needs to be refueled, would actually be removed and replaced with a new reactor. And so there isn't even this kind of on-site refueling in some cases associated with these.
Ms. Whitman, I'd like to pause just briefly, let the record reflect that Representative Rauscher joined us at 10:32 a.m., and we have a question from Representative Fields. I also suspect we're going to start getting some questions as we get into the presentation, so if you could just pause briefly at the end of each slide. With that, Representative Fields.
Thanks to the Chair. Ms. Holdman, thanks for sharing this information. And could you just provide a little more detail on load following and the time it takes to scale up or ramp down these microreactors and maybe put that in the context of a gas peaking plant or, you know, a flywheel that you might have for backup energy or some of the other parts of a portfolio? Thank you.
Thank you. Through the chair, this is actually a really important question that I'm interested in understanding a little bit better myself. I can tell you that, you know, a lot of these, again, like the power generation piece of this is similar to conventional power generation systems. So you would have the same sort of capabilities that you might have in terms of load following with conventional steam generation or something like that. Some of these reactors have an intermediate source where they're storing the heat. So, for example, in a molten salt, tank or something like that, where the reactor maybe doesn't ramp up and down that quickly, but they're able to change the output to keep that that intermediate sort of thermal storage device at some sort of a continual temperature and then use the heat from that to drive a turbine and be able to ramp that up and down. I don't think that they're going to be able to to ramp up and down as quickly as a peaking plant, but pretty close to that. I mean, certainly within a minute or two. And one of the things that I have a question about is not necessarily the technical ability, but the economic feasibility of using it in that manner. Because just because it can load follow doesn't necessarily mean that's the economically optimal way to operate these things. And that's part of what I would like to understand.
Can I just ask a follow-up?
Please, Representative Fields.
So looking across generation sources, what is the time frame or how fast does a generation source have to be able to respond to say it is a load following source? Is it 1 to 2 minutes, like you said, or is it something else?
No, I mean, I think that load following would certainly be within that. If it's able to kind of ramp up and down over some period of, you know, a minute or two to follow a load profile, that's, or in this case, maybe more interestingly, generation of a non, of a variable renewable resource, that's sort of what we're talking about by being able to follow a load curve like that. Now, the actual, we also have very, very quick fluctuations in terms of grid output and supply. And so sometimes you also need another buffer in there that can respond more quickly. But generally speaking, load following technology is somewhere in that sort of, you know, within a couple minutes of response time.
Great, thank you.
Please continue.
Okay. Let's see, next slide, please. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I do think it's illustrative of the kinds of systems that are out there and the sort of the break in terms of sizing of these systems. So this is a logarithmic scale on the left side. This is a chart that we made for the report that we shared with the committee. And you can see there's sort of this like lot of activity in this sort of smaller scale. The increasing maturity level, kind of that x-axis, I would suggest please don't pay too much attention to that because this is continually evolving, and that was our best guess a year ago. But you can see that there's like quite a few different companies out there. I don't even think we've captured them all in this sort of under 10 megawatt sort of scale. We have selected as sort of a threshold 50 megawatts of electric. That aligns with federal code and federal legislation, but you can kind of see there's sort of a clear break there below 50 megawatts of electric, where these systems that are larger than this are more on a modular reactor scale or have different applications that probably wouldn't be as relevant to the Alaska use cases. Next slide, please.
And Representative Kleeman has a question.
Turning back to one of the earlier slides when you were referencing your timeline of, this is on the recommendations slide, and one of the bullets was create a roadmap for Alaska nuclear applications, including specific use cases and a robust economic analysis. And then the next bullet was to review and revise the Alaska statutes related to nuclear energy. And my query is, where are you on the roadmap with specific cases and applications? Because I think one of the natural questions, because this legislation would essentially take it out of the legislator's authority to where we're going to place a nuclear reactor, where are you on this roadmap that would tell us where you would be trying to put a nuclear reactor as we look at potentially revising statutes?
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, you know, we have limited ability to make determinations about where a reactor might go, but we can look at a bunch of different potential and prospective use cases and look at some of the economics associated with that. Department of Environmental Conservation is going to be playing a major role in terms of looking at siting and state regulation related to microreactors. That's already included in existing state statutes, and that does not change. Neither does local authority related to the deployment of any microreactor. The roadmap is really kind of looking at these broader questions and identifying areas or unknowns that we might have in terms of potentially allowing communities or industry to look at this as a possible option. We have not done very much work in this space yet. We are actually hoping that there will be some separate funding through the university's budget process to support the development of this roadmap, and that I believe maybe in a supplemental budget bill that will be coming out sometime in the next couple of weeks. That's my understanding of it. So we haven't made significant progress, but we've been working toward putting the pieces together and bringing the stakeholders together to make sure that we're ready to lay this out pretty quickly.
Follow-up, Representative Clayman? Okay. Representative Rauscher.
Thank you, Chair Shoggy. Thank you. If I could go back to the slide we just left.
I believe that was slide 10.
There you go.
10.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And basically, the red circle is around what is in the red writing. It says the microreactor technology is under development for the U.S. market. Is that a federal regulation that confines us to that? Or what confines us to that statement?
So any reactor design that would be deployed in Alaska would have to be licensed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So that's the federal cogent agency. And so that's when we're talking about technologies that would be under development for the U.S. market. Those are ones that are either currently working with the NRC or planning to go through NRC a licensing process.
Follow-up, Representative Rauscher?
I apologize, but I don't think my question was answered.
Would you like to maybe restate?
I just want another shot at it there. Microreactor technologies under development for the U.S. market is what that is labeled, and I'm just wondering, is that because of a federal regulation of permitting policies that we have, or what's the reason that we're limited to that?
These are vendors that are actively planning to seek NRC approval or licensing for their design, and any reactor design that might be developed in another country that isn't planning to go through NRC licensing wouldn't really be a technology that could be deployed in the U.S. market. And so these are technologies that have identified themselves or vendors that have identified an interest in deploying their technology in the U.S. market. Does that help?
Yeah, no, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay.
And one more question, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, so basically they're limiting themselves at the 10 megawatts. There isn't anybody else that's limiting them regulation-wise or anything else?
No.
This is the market that they have identified that they need to go into to be viable. Okay, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yes.
I did have one.
Yes.
And I would just note for the committee that federal requirements for small reactors is a reactor below 50 megawatts, so there is a threshold there. But Representative Clayman, a question?
There were some earlier questions about what I would call peaking power, or access to the peaking loads rather than kind of baseline loads. And I know it's always been my understanding that one of the big applications for hydropower, because it's easy to ramp up and ramp down without a lot of stress and strain on the infrastructure for that generation, that hydropower has always been one of the favorites for providing peaking power, and that kind of some of the fossil fuel-based power plants do much better at a steady state production. Where does nuclear fit on that spectrum, if you know?
I appreciate that. I'm trying to process that statement. I'm not certain that that's always true. I mean, there's the technical ability of the turbine to load follow and ramp up and down. There is some limitations with hydro on that because there's a penstock involved, there's water flowing down a pipe, and so there's a period of time that it takes to adjust the output of a turbine like that. And often hydro is our lowest cost generation source, so sometimes you want to use that for baseline. There's an economic consideration here too, and that's why gas plants, even though they're more expensive to operate in the lower 48, are often used for peaking because they can ramp up and down very quickly. They're not necessarily the cheapest to operate. Hydro or nuclear in the lower 48 is probably the least expensive to operate typically. From the perspective of a microreactor, it's very similar to that. What they're capable of doing and what is economic for them to do is the question that I would have as part of a roadmap development process. But in this particular case, reactor technology is really just a heat plant. So think of it as like a coal plant, some source of heat, geothermal plant, that's then driving a conventional steam generation turbine. So in that respect, it's not that different from a hydropower turbine or a coal plant. They can't respond instantaneously, but they can respond fairly quickly.
Thank you.
And Representative Rauscher, did you have another question?
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Gwen, please, Ms. Holdman, please do continue.
Okay. Thanks. So I think we're on slide 11. Is that?
That's what
I can't
Gwen.
See the slides. So the example MNRs under development. So example micro nuclear reactors that are under development. I just put two in here. I think it's just illustrative of sort of a conceptual design and a size from a physical standpoint that these developers are looking at. These are two that I just selected to be examples because they both expressed interest in the Alaska market. So UltraSafe Nuclear Corporation is one that has about a 10 megawatt electric design. And then the other one is this Westinghouse eVinci reactor, which design is about 5 megawatts of electric output. So those are just kind of a couple of conceptual designs. And if we have questions about that, Ashley would be the one that might be able to help support that.
Representative Zlokowski.
Thank you, Ms. Holdman. Can you touch on the capacity needed to manage systems like this? I'm interested in better understanding, in a district like mine, there are some electric utility cooperatives, but there are a lot of freestanding single community systems. And so I'd be interested to understand a little bit more what is needed on the ground in terms of staff oversight and management of these types of systems.
If it'd be okay, I'd love to call on Dr. Finnan, Ashley Finnan, to maybe answer that
Please.
Question.
Thank you, Gwen, and thank you, Representative, for the question. I'll do my best to answer it, but if I fail, please let me know. So I think from an operating standpoint, many of the advanced reactors, and in particular the micro reactors that are under development, are working to have a smaller operating staff on site, and they're also developing a business model that includes providing that operational capability. So that could be something that is drawn out of the local population if the capability exists, but there's a lot of precedent for experienced nuclear operating companies actually sending either personnel or training to the location of a nuclear reactor that does not have a local operating capability. So I think we'd be looking at a model where the expertise and resources would be brought to the facility. We wouldn't necessarily see vendors expecting to find that on site. And then typically the NRC provides regulatory oversight with resident inspectors. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has inspectors all around the country. I don't think in Alaska right now, but around the continental U.S. Where they have personnel who are on site at nuclear facilities providing that oversight function. Some of these details are yet to be finalized in terms of exact number of operators, but those discussions are taking place with the regulator right now because these adjustments to operating modes will need to be reviewed and approved by the regulator in order to move forward. Does that answer the question?
Representative Zlokowski, do you have a follow-up? And just a quick reminder for our testifiers, if you could please re-put yourself on the record before speaking, it helps our record secretary. Thank you.
Thank you. Just a follow-up question then. That definitely does answer my question and is very helpful. I'd be interested to hear scenarios where not having somebody immediately available in the community to provide support could have potential impacts with respect to if there was a community off the road system that has infrequent access to transportation in terms of being able to get somebody on site rather quickly if that was needed. I guess what sort of safeguards are there in place to make sure that there's not any harm that's done to a community that puts a system like this in place if there's not somebody locally available? You know, in a district like mine, communities are spread out over vast stretches of land. There can sometimes be weather conditions that inhibit flights from getting in to bring operators for various systems into the community. So I'd be interested in hearing how micro reactor operations would be able to ensure safety of local folks and local environmental conditions.
So I think this is Ashley Steinman. Gwen, do you want me to respond or not?
Go ahead, Ashley.
Okay, that's a great question, and I think the key safety valve there is that the regulator is going to look at those scenarios. The NRC, the U.S. NRC, will look at those scenarios and evaluate whether the safety standard can be met given the conditions in the community, which, you know, as you're describing, are at times extreme. The way that advanced reactors are approaching this is that many of the designs, in fact, most of them, are being designed such that they don't require intervention in case of something going wrong. So if they lose off-site power, the reactor is designed to shut down on its own without operator action, without emergency services. But all of those things would need to be evaluated and approved by the regulator, who would consider all of the scenarios that you're starting to think of, but they would look very carefully at it. That would be my response on that one. Gwen, I'll pass it back to you.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Finnan. I will just add on to that, NRC.
Ms. Holdman, yes. If you could please put yourself back on the record whenever you take over the presentation again. Thank you.
Absolutely, yeah. This is Gwen Holdman, the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. And I just wanted to add on to that comment that in the case of these microreactors, a couple of things. Like, number one, the NRC process for licensing, it's a two-phase process. There's a license for the technology itself. So that's when we looked at those reactor designs that are considering going through NRC licensing process for the technology, for the reactor design. The second step is a site license. And so that's kind of what Dr. Finnan is talking about here. There's going to be a specific license, and again, this is at the national, not at the state level, but for that particular site to make sure that the site can adhere to the safety standards that the NRC is developing for the deployment of these kinds of systems. And I'll further add on to that, that at this point in time, we're not really envisioning deployment of these in really very remote communities. This is still fairly complex technology, even not thinking about the reactor. But again, that power generation piece, like if you're using, say, a steam generation system, that in itself has inherent, probably more significant safety issues potentially associated to it, requiring trained personnel. And so we're really like looking at the size of these reactors and sort of where they might be applicable. In rural settings, it would be more a hub community or potentially an industrial site.
Please continue.
Slide 12, Ryan.
Ms. Holdman, I believe you're correct. We are on slide 12.
Okay, great. Thank you. I just can't see the slides myself. So passive safety, I did want to chat just briefly or share a little bit more about what this means, because I know that this is something that's of real interest to stakeholders when I speak with them. So this 50 megawatt electric threshold, or whatever that is, that's an arbitrary number. It's really not about the size of the output. That's sort of just like you're saying, the reactor vendors have identified a market in this smaller under 10 megawatt electric output range, and that's sort of why we're kind of picking a bit of an arbitrary threshold. There's nothing magic about 50 megawatts of electric, but these attributes that Dr. Finnan mentioned that are associated with these small micro reactor designs, at least those that are being developed for the U.S. market, are more associated with this concept of an advanced reactor, and a big part of that is this passive safety component. That includes, as Dr. Finnan mentioned, that they automatically shut down. If there's some sort of an unexpected event, power is lost to the system, they are naturally essentially going to wind down. That's the passive safety feature associated with those. There's not going to be active measures that are required to continue to cool that reactor in the event of some sort of unexpected thing happening. And then secondly, the fuel itself, there is really being designed or configured in ways that in itself can prevent any sort of accidental release of any sort of radioactive material into the environment. And this is really where Dr. McDowell could come in. and speak a little bit about that if there's specific questions about the fuel configuration. But essentially, you know, we've really come a long ways in terms of advanced materials that are really both resistant from a thermal standpoint and also just from a mechanical standpoint. And a lot of these example of this TRISO fuel that many of these reactors are planning to use, the actual material, the nuclear material, is actually encapsulated in these multiple layers of different sorts of ceramic materials and such that are really, that make it very difficult to have any sort of accidental release of material into the environment.
Wonderful. And I believe Representative Rauscher has a question maybe on the prior slide, was it?
Yeah, but it doesn't really matter. And also the representative next to me, but I may sound a little naive through the chair, I may sound a little naive here. Are these test driven before they get here, or don't they need to be?
That's actually, thank you, and through the chair, that is a really excellent question. The plan right now is actually for many of these reactor technologies to be tested at the National Reactor test site that ASHLEI is running. And so, ASHLEI, if you, Dr. Finnan, would mind putting yourself back on a record and speaking to the process for deploying and testing these reactor technologies, I would appreciate that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Gwen. This is ASHLEI Finnan. Gwen is quite right that many of these technologies are pursuing demonstration projects right now, including in Idaho at the Idaho National Laboratory, as well as elsewhere around the country, including in Wyoming, in Washington State, and in Tennessee. I have a chart on my slides that I use a lot, and there are about nine or so reactors that we see in the demonstration process between now and 2029. So there are a lot of those projects that are moving forward, and most of them do not see Alaska as the site for the first demonstration, but rather a place that clean energy is very needed, and it might be a great place for microreactors to contribute.
Follow-up?
Right. Thank you.
Very good. And Representative Fields?
Thanks. Actually, kind of have a follow-up to that question. So has this fuel configuration been tested, or are you saying through the chair that it will be tested? And then the corresponding question is, I guess there are some differences between the reactor configurations across companies, and in terms of a safety process, do the national labs test sort of one representative configuration, or do they actually test every single configuration that's going to be deployed on the market?
So through the chair, I would like to, Dr. Finnan, are you the right
Ms.
person
Holdman,
to answer that question?
Ms. Holdman,
yes.
If you could put yourself on the record when speaking. Sorry, I know it's
right,
difficult.
Okay.
Thank you.
this is Gwen Holdman, Director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I would like to call on either Dr. Finnan or Dr. McDowell to respond to that question.
Gwen, this is ASHLEI Finnan. I can take that, or at least I can start it, and then if Dr. McDowell wants to jump in, he can put himself on the record. The fuel, in particular, Gwen Holdman was mentioning the TRISO fuel, and that's a really well-developed fuel that the Idaho National Laboratory, as well as other labs, have been working on for more than a decade now to get that qualified and ready for use in the United States with NRC's Nuclear Regulatory Commission approval. But prior to that, previous versions of that fuel have been tested for decades in South Africa, and Germany, and they're also now operating a similar reactor in China that uses a very similar fuel. It's the same concept, same basic materials, but the U.S. companies are really building it to a particular performance standard through qualification process with the NRC, and it's very well developed, very well tested at this point, and it will continue to be tested. Tests are going to be going into reactors at INL and elsewhere in the coming years. To continue to verify that it's performing as expected.
I have a follow-up.
Representative Fields?
Thanks, through the chair. So maybe I didn't understand this. Are these different companies with different reactor configurations actually using the same TRISO fuel or anticipate using the same TRISO fuel?
This is ASHLEI Finnan. Gwen, do you want me to take that?
Please do.
Okay. So again, Ashley Finan speaking for the record. And there are several different types of fuel being used in the advanced reactors that are developing projects for the market today. Many of them are using this TRISO fuel. Some of them have slight variations on the same TRISO fuel. The fundamental quality of that fuel is that it's a ceramic that contains the fission products. And so if there's a loss of coolant, the fission products are contained in the fuel rather than released. That's a particular type of fuel, and there are several variations, but it's the same concept. And probably around half of the advanced reactors are using that design. Then among the others, there are several other fuel designs being pursued. All of them are taking a passive safety approach consistent with what Ms. Holdman designed, or rather described earlier, but some of them are taking a somewhat different approach to achieve that passive safety outcome.
Yes, one more question on this.
Yes, passive. Representative Fields, I suspected you might have a follow-up.
Thanks. I assume when a company says, oh, we have a passive cooling design, so there's nothing to worry about, I assume that the national labs test that or stress test it. And could you, I guess, Ms. Finan, through the chair, just explain how that is tested and validated before technology is deployed in the field?
Absolutely. Thank you for the question. So the technology does get validated through the national laboratories, and tests are run. There's a transient experimental test facility at Idaho National Lab called TREAT, where you're able to put samples of the fuel in a reactor and then run really exceptional transients, which are basically accident conditions, where you go to very high temperatures and you test the fuel under extreme conditions that are more extreme than have ever been encountered in our operations or we would expect to encounter, but you get to make the fuel fail and see what it takes to make the fuel fail and how that looks so that we can observe failure and understand what it looks like and understand exactly when that's going to happen and make sure that our modeling and simulation is accurate so that we tune that and we can look at all of the operating parameters but know where failure is and that we're not going to hit it. Further, I mentioned the reactor in China. They've actually operated that and demonstrated passive safety, demonstrated that, in fact, if you let it go, it'll shut down when something goes wrong. And that's not the only place that's been done. It's been done elsewhere in the U.S. in the past. And finally, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. So the labs can do these tests, but the labs don't have the final say on whether something's safe. It's the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission that's going to evaluate the data, ensure that it meets their quality standards, ensure that the tests are adequate and they're satisfied, and they'll make the final safety finding on whether those passive safety features are sufficient.
Thank you, Dr. Finan. Now I'd like to go to Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. To the chair, the point of order, I've been told that the streaming has been a little hiccupy today, so just to be aware of, I don't know if we can do anything. It may be a bandwidth issue. With that, so I'd say to Director Holdman, a couple of questions about safety. As I recall, these encapsulated fuels, there was a demonstration reactor in Germany that was maybe decades ago at this point. Is that the case? Is that how old some of this encapsulated fuel technology is?
Thank you. Through the chair. Wow. As Dr. Finan mentioned, a lot of this evolution in terms of thinking around these different fuel configurations is not new. I don't know specifically about any reactor test that was done in Germany a couple of decades ago, but this is definitely something, as Dr. Finan said, the fuel is a really important piece of all of this, and so really designing that fuel in ways that sort of supports the sort of passive or inherent safety attributes associated with these advanced reactors has been a pretty important piece of all of this. So, and fabricating that fuel is an important piece of what this reactor, what the pipeline and the for broader deployment of these systems might look like someday.
Thank you, Director Holdman. And follow up, Representative Rauscher. Oh, my gosh, Kaufman, excuse me.
Representative Kaufman here, through the chair to Director Holdman. On slide 11, there's in the diagram of the Westinghouse design, There's what's noted as the emergency driver and the control drum driver. Could you just explain the function of those?
Dr. Finan, would you be able to talk a little bit more about how that relates to the passive safety features associated with the Westinghouse eVinci reactor specifically?
For the record. Hi, this is Ashley Finan. I just got unmuted. So Gwen, thank you for the question. I can't see the slide or the diagram, but I can say that control drum drivers and emergency drivers, those should be ways of inserting negative reactivity into the reactor, which essentially shuts down the nuclear reaction by putting a material in that will absorb neutrons. But I'm sorry I can't see the diagram, so I can't speak to it any more than that right now. But I'd be very, very happy to follow up with a detailed response.
Follow up, Representative Kaufman.
Thank you, Representative Kaufman here through the chair. My impression, because of the smaller, more compact nature of these, that they are inherently better in seismic areas. Could we just have a brief discussion of seismic considerations with reactors of these smaller sizes and more compact installation? Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you for that question through the chair. I think this might be a good opportunity
if you could put yourself on the record. I know it's so difficult. Thank you.
Sorry, yes. Okay, Gwen Holdman, Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I'd like to pass that question to Bruce McDowell from PNNL. Could you please put yourself on the record?
Yeah, this is Bruce McDowell, PNNL. Could you repeat the question, please?
The question is related to concerns about operation of these in a seismic area and what sort of features related to the safety and passive features would also relate to deploying one of these in an area where there could be active seismic zones.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for the question. Again, Bruce McDowell from the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. The NRC is, this is one of the areas where the NRC does a safety review and an environmental review. Any place where there's a reactor sited, you have to look at how the reactor will impact the environment and how the environment will impact the reactor. And one of those ways is, the potential for ground movement at the location where the reactor would be sited. And so the NRC would look at how the reactor is designed, what kind of stresses the reactor is designed to. Design basis seismic activity is one thing that that's how the reactors design their plants. They choose ground motion thresholds and parameters, and then they design their plants to withstand those. Then the NRC, in turn, looks at those parameters and then they look at the design and make sure that the design can withstand those types of stresses. Now, that's during the design type review. When they actually look at a specific site, then what they do is they look at what types of ground motion could happen at that site based upon known faults and historical observations, and make a determination of whether it would be safe to site that plant at that site with the known seismic activity. So that is the process that they would go through, and it very well may be that there's some places where the seismic activity is larger than the plant is designed to withstand. So during the review, NRC would make those evaluations. Thank you.
Not seeing any other questions, please continue, Ms. Holdman.
Thank you. This is Gwen Holdman with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I guess if we could just go to slide 13, just very quickly, I just wanted to make this point about I think about how heat is extracted from the reactors in sorts of ways that sort of support that sort of passive design. Some of these reactors, such as the eVinci, are designed to use heat pipes. The way I like to talk about that when I give presentations in Alaska is that's really a similar technology in terms of passive removal of heat to the systems, the heat pipes that we use on the Trans-Alaska pipeline. In that case, we're removing heat from the ground using anhydrous pneumonia. Obviously, in the case of an eVinci reactor or something like that, we'd be using different sorts of working fluids, but the concept is essentially the same from that passive removal of heat from the reactor core. And then as Dr. Finan was mentioning, you know, this idea that you're really using these moderators to kind of control the speed of the reaction, that's part of how this load following happens too, in terms of just output of the heat from the reactor and being able to moderate that to some extent. So if we wanted to move on to slide 14, this is a list of some of the statutes that currently relate to nuclear energy or that do relate to nuclear energy in terms of state statutes. We went through these for our 2021 report pretty carefully and took a look at which ones might make sense to update based on the evolution of the technology since the 40 years or so since these statutes were originally written. They were certainly written with an eye toward conventional gigawatt kind of scale nuclear reactor technology. And so we identified three statutes that we thought were worth looking at and proposing some changes to. Slide 15 sort of highlights those in red. I'm going to actually start from the bottom. So the bottom one, and this is one of the things that this particular bill proposes, is to add a definition specific to what a microreactor is and aligning that with a federal definition that's actually contained in the Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act. And that also then relates to the standard for an advanced nuclear reactor as defined in federal code. And so that's where we thought it made sense to align state statutes with these federal definitions. So that's the first thing that this bill proposes. I guess I'll stop there and see if there's a question.
I'm not seeing questions. Please continue.
Okay, great. So the second thing that it does is that there's two additional requirements. I actually did interview a couple of former legislators that were involved in developing some of these requirements to just make sure I understood some of the concerns at that time or the rationale for that. In particular, this section 18.45.030, which is really about these sort of continuing studies required by six different state agencies related to any sort of nuclear-related project in the state of Alaska. And this is a pretty pretty onerous requirement. This is separate from just permitting of any project as you would do in the state. This is sort of a continual studies requirement that we don't think is necessary given the all of the permitting that is required anyway for a microreactor at both the national and the state level. And so we would suggest that for a microreactor, so falling under that definition of under 50 megawatts of electric power output, that these are not required, these additional studies, these ongoing studies. It would still be required for any project larger than that in scale. And then the third thing that we recommended changing, and this was really flagged at the federal level as being a little bit unique about Alaska, is this legislative siting authority over any project, again, any nuclear energy project in the state of Alaska. And so we are proposing to remove that additional legislative authority over a project that is 50 megawatts or under. So that falls under this microreactor definition. And the reason for that is because these are small systems. It's more of a local concern. And it does not remove any kind of control over local siting authority related to these sorts of microreactors. So those are the three things that this bill proposes to change in existing statutes.
Please continue.
All right. So I guess just really in conclusion, one of the questions that we have is, you know, do microreactors have a role in Alaska's future energy mix? I would like to point toward our a sister program that we work closely with, the Center for Economic Development at UAA, that's been working with us on some of the use case analysis funded through Department of Energy, looking at these kinds of systems. Slide 17 kind of gives a few examples of some of the potential use cases that they identified, including a rural hub community, rail belt applications, military base, and then a mining operation. And so that report sort of outlined on a broad level, like some of those opportunities in Alaska that we would like to explore a little bit further through a road mapping process. Moving to slide 18,
Director
this is
Holdman,
actually from our...
Director Holdman,
yes.
We have a couple of questions. First going to Representative Zlokowski.
Thank you, Director Holdman. I appreciate the dialogue around innovative energy solutions and how Alaska can diversify its portfolio and the opportunities that we're hearing about this morning. I would be interested to hear a little bit more about what kind of potential impacts this technology could have in terms of environmental impacts. You know, I appreciate the clarity around being able to be a solution for rural hub communities. From my district and other rural districts, I've often heard that they're seeing trends and data that indicate some warming of permafrost that has escalated recently, which has had different impacts on existing infrastructure. They're seeing data that supports warming river systems, so different species of fish are returning or are coming to our river systems and may not necessarily have returns that they've seen in other types of species of fish. So I'd love to hear a little bit more on the record about potential environmental impacts related to this technology, both in the immediate context of it being in place, but also potentially long-term.
Thank you, Representative Zlokowski. Yeah, and I really do appreciate that question. I'm going to turn that over to Dr. McDowell here in a moment, but I do want to just point out that there is a lot of inherent uncertainty in rural Alaska. We work quite a bit on energy issues related to rural applications in particular, and that's pretty near and dear to our heart. And one of the other things that there's a lot of uncertainty around is, you know, the cost of fuel in the future. And so one of the things that I am excited about when it comes to this technology is the idea that we might have more certainty, both in terms of delivery of fuel and long-term price structures associated with fuel. And that's not just for electric power, but potentially heat too, that could really support different sorts of business opportunities in rural Alaska than maybe we've thought about previously. And so from the standpoint of energy security in rural Alaska, this is, in my mind, an interesting option that's worth exploring along with different kinds of opportunities. For the Bethel area in particular, I could envision a future where you might have a microreactor centrally located in a hub community like Bethel. And I'm just sort of talking very long term here, but potentially using excess power from that reactor, excess heat, to produce hydrogen or ammonia, and then being able to use that to supply outlying communities, which could open up some really different opportunities and options there. You know, so there's a lot of ways to think about this. We're not necessarily promoting this technology, but I think it's worth exploring as part of a broader sort of suite of options for our communities in this state. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. McDowell, if you could put yourself back on the record, since I keep forgetting to do that, and address the question about sort of what are the possible environmental negative implications for having a microreactor in a community. What would you be concerned about?
Okay, thank you. This is Bruce McDowell from Pinanella. I'd like to just note, Gwen, thank you for the compliment, but I am not a doctor. I just make that part of the record. So when you think about how a reactor could be sited in Alaska, I mean, there's so much that is different than the large light water reactors that have been sited and operated in the United States. You know, the size obviously is much smaller, so you have a much smaller footprint. Most of the reactors don't have water as a coolant, so you don't need water as a cooling source. You know, the foundations would be different. Nobody in the United States is worried about permafrost or how that could change over time. So there's really unique aspects about Alaska that haven't been dealt with before, and so those are going to be challenges for the NRC when they do their environmental impact statements or their studies of what types of impacts could occur. And then you also permafrost is one. I mean, how do you what is the appropriate foundation? What is the appropriate setting for a reactor the size of the Westinghouse eVinci reactor, which could be delivered on a truck, versus the Vogtle reactor, which is a 1,000 megawatts down in Georgia, a much, much different question. Would permafrost, a sighting on a permafrost be appropriate? I mean, I don't think that question has really been evaluated yet, and that would be part of what the NRC would be looking at. And another aspect that you brought up is that there's communities that are seeing changes in their environment. The way NRC looks at the potential for climate change is they see that as a change in a baseline condition that needs to be considered when you license a plant for 40 years, for instance. So they look at, okay, if there's going to be a plant that's constructed and built and operated today, there's a certain baseline condition that you have to be aware of and how the plant might affect that environment. But you also have to consider that that baseline condition could change over the next 40 years, and you don't just look at the environmental impact today. You look at the potential environmental impact that could be happening 40 years from now. So that's another very difficult question that that would be unique for Alaska, certainly, and that would NRC would consider in their environmental review. And how does permafrost change over time? I mean, if you have a foundation that looks like it's viable today, but it may change in the future, that would be one of the safety aspects that NRC would look at in their evaluation. So all those things would be new in the sense that the unique aspects of Alaska would have to be considered in ways that haven't been considered in the continental United States before. Hopefully it gave some perspective on that question.
Representative Fields.
Thanks, through the chair. Just curious about people who follow the industry. I think the price per kilowatt hour that UltraSafe Nuclear is looking at for Valdez is 20 cents a kilowatt hour. That would be maybe a good deal in some places in Alaska. Still orders of magnitude more expensive than most places power is generated in the lower 48. What potential do you see to reduce that price per kilowatt hour to even being close to competitive with the sort of renewable plus storage mixes that we're seeing in the lower 48?
So thank you, Representative Fields. This is Gwen Holdman, Alaska Center for Energy and Power. I can say that getting our hands wrapped around the economics of these systems is very difficult. I think that the companies, we've worked quite a lot with providing them with data on Alaska use cases from sort of an economic standpoint. There's a lot of open questions in terms of what the like costs will be, what the requirements from the NRC ultimately will be for an individual site or reactor technology that sort of helps that inform some of those prices. So, looking at the cost or, what ultimately the all-in price will be for electric power generated from these reactors is a big, big question that I think everybody has right now. And there are a lot of inherent uncertainties associated with that at this point in time. And that's a big part of what we're trying to understand from developing a roadmap. Part of that is, too, valuing heat that might be available from a reactor in addition to the electric power. It's a fairly complicated puzzle. And I think that honestly, one of my last slides is really about this Eielson Air Force project. There's going to be a request for proposal coming out later this month or next month, or that's at least the timeline at which that's planned. And in that case, that project is really designed, this under 5 megawatt sort of size project, as being a commercial project where the where the project developer would essentially enter into a power purchase agreement with the Air Force, and in for them to purchase heat and power from that system. And so I think that, in my mind, that's actually going to be a really, really interesting data point in terms of understanding better the costs or the potential or prospective opportunity space in terms of the economics associated with these systems.
That's a follow-up. Follow-up, Representative Fields. I think some of us have heard from the city of Valdez about their interest in getting a small-scale reactor. And, you know, for a local government or someone who is potentially interested in this energy, does your organization or who else might be able to provide some consulting services to make sure that they're able to negotiate a good deal in terms of the price per kilowatt hour? Just because it seems like with such a new technology, it's, if I was a local government official, I would have a hard time understanding what is a good deal. So who can help our local governments with that as they seek to utilize this technology?
Thank you, through the chair. I really appreciate that question, actually. And one of the things that we've been really careful to do at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power is not enter into an NDA with any particular vendor, because we want to be that resource or a resource for communities or other stakeholders in Alaska that have questions about this particular technology. There's very few people in the state of Alaska that are really knowledgeable in this space. I actually count myself among those. I've just been trying to inform myself and understand this technology space better over time as one of many different energy options that we have, you know, for the state. And so that need, I think, to have like an honest third-party information broker has been a role that we've been playing. And that's, again, where I'm very, very fortunate to have the support from the National Labs and from the Department of Energy to support Alaska and support the Alaska Center for Energy and Power in terms of trying to get that information out to Alaskans. We have about 20 participants from National Labs that regularly join our Alaska working group, and we hear a lot, not just from vendors, but from folks like Ashley Finan and others that can help kind of inform Alaskans and make sure that they have good information to make good decisions about that. That particular project that you mentioned in Valdez, you know, that's something that Copper Valley Electric Association is interested in doing a feasibility study around. And I think that part of the genesis of that is that ASEP, Alaska Center for Energy and Power, had an internship program that we worked closely with utilities. And 2 years ago, we worked with them to place an intern with Copper Valley Electric Association specifically to explore this question about whether a micro reactor would be something that could make sense as part of their future energy mix. I don't know if that feasibility study will come out to say that does make sense for them, but those are the kinds of resources that we're hoping to try to provide to communities and stakeholders around Alaska. This is an interesting space. I'm very interested in these use cases. I'd like to see how microreactors might not just support a rural application like that, but also potentially give us alternatives for trying to make our rail belt energy system more robust in the future as well. So that's a space that I do think that the university can play a role in.
Thank you, Dr. Holdman. And Representative Klayman has a question.
So on the Eielson Air Force Base pilot project, does that require any statutory change by the legislature for that to go forward? That's the first part of the question. The second part of the question is, would we still need to approve the siting location that the Air Force chose as they go forward?
Thank you, Representative Klayman. Through the chair, that for the Eielson project, it will be subject. The NRC has been fairly clear, and I think that's been, I have heard, you know, no one disagree with the perspective that that project will be subject to any relevant state statutes or laws. And so if this bill is not passed, if it's passed, then it would fall under that exemption. And the Fairbanks North Star Borough, there would still need to be siting approval at the local level, but it would not fall under legislative siting authority. If this bill is not passed in some sort of a unknown period of time, I'm not sure what that would look like, then it would come to the legislature for approval of that project. And that is my current understanding of the process.
Thank you.
And Director Holdman, I have a question. Do any other states require legislative approval for siting, or is Alaska unique in some respect?
So It is my understanding that Alaska is somewhat unique in this legislative siting requirement. I would like to actually potentially ask if Dr. Finan has a perspective on that, and that is something I could get back to the committee on, because this is what I've been told, but I haven't done specific research on that, and I would like to follow up on that. Dr. Finan, could you put yourself on the record and let me know if you're aware of any other states that have similar statutes?
Thank you. This is Ashley Finan. Gwen, I'm sorry. Can you repeat which type of statute?
The legislative siting requirement, so where the state legislature has final siting authority over a project of any size related to nuclear energy in the state.
Okay, thank you. So there are a variety of different laws around the country for a few different states that have variations on that. Some have a voter approval, some have a legislative approval, but we have those data, so we could provide a list of which states and what their restrictions are in follow-up to the question.
Thank you. Not seeing any other questions at the moment, please continue.
Well, I think that more or less brings me to the end of our presentation. It looks like, I don't know where you are on the slides, but if you wanted to go to slide 20 or 21, that's related to the Eielson project, that's received some attention here. There's a timeline on that. Slide 22 references this Alaska roadmap that we actually started to lay out as a little bit of a process back in 2011 timeframe, that kind of talks about these different stage gates related to whether the technology exists, whether the technology is safe, whether it is environmentally safe, whether it's environmentally, whether it's a prudent technology for us to look at deploying in the Alaska environment, and then whether the economics work. And so whatever order you might want to look at that, this is kind of like a bit of a stage gate process that we laid out at that time. This is not a current document, but it just gives you some idea of the kinds of process that we might go through there. And then slide 23, just really in summary, these are the reasons why I personally have become interested in microreactors. I have a background in mechanical engineering and physics. I've worked in the energy industry for a very long time. I'm interested in looking at low carbon solutions generally. And these, for me, reasons why Alaska should at least be considering this as part of a broader suite of options for the future of our state. I like the fact that it can provide baseload power, unlike a lot of our variable renewables, but can potentially load follow, carbon free. I believe that this is a safer technology than we typically or traditionally have thought about nuclear energy. There needs to be a path to competitive pricing or these systems won't be adopted. So hopefully we'll figure out what that path is, and that's not an Alaska-specific question. So this better long-term certainty in terms of energy costs is a big one for me. We import a lot of our fuel, especially to rural Alaska, and that creates a huge amount of cost uncertainty for especially rural parts of our state, but even some of our more urban markets. And so this is something that I'm interested in, is this greater price stability, both for electric heat and power, for heat and power. And then these questions around environmental contamination, I really appreciated some of the questions from Representative Zulkowski, sorry. She brings up this question about protecting our pretty sensitive environment. And one of the things that we're trying to do at the Alaska Center for Energy and Power is really trying to quantify what the environmental cost for some status quo energy sources are. You know, right now there's a tremendous amount of contamination in many of our communities related to diesel fuel spills and heating oil. And so there's a environmental cost associated with the status quo too. And so trying to understand what that is and comparing that to potential future alternatives is something that we're really looking at and interested in exploring a little bit further. And so I do think this could potentially complement other existing and prospective future energy mixes for Alaska. And so I think it's something that I would like to keep the door open in terms of continuing to explore this technology, and this bill really does that. It keeps the door open. It doesn't mean that we're going to have a microreactor deployed anywhere in Alaska. We don't necessarily control that, but it keeps the door open for communities, for Department of Defense, and for industry in Alaska to consider this as a potential future option if the technology is available.
Thank you, Director Holdman. I am not seeing further questions at this time. Very informative presentation. I know the committee really appreciates learning about this issue in such depth. Our next meeting is going to be Thursday, February 10th. At that meeting, the committee will have a presentation from the Nuclear Energy Institute. With nothing else before the committee at this time, we are adjourned at 11:34 a.m. Thank you.